for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Earth's population currently stands at about 6.8 billion. It's projected to exceed 9 billion by 2050, but growth will be uneven. Latin America, the Middle East, and Sub-Saharan Africa will see sharp increases. Many other areas of the world will see the rate of growth continue to decline. Joining me to talk about world population trends as part of our ongoing series on the environment, William Butts of the Population Reference Bureau, joining us from a studio in California, Paul Ehrlich. He's professor of population studies at Stanford University. And from an NPR studio in New York, Hanya Zlotnik. She's director of the Population Division at the United Nations. We do invite your calls, questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And you can also send us a tweet. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning,
good morning,
Diane.
Good morning, Diane.
Good. And Bill, if I could start with you, give us an update on the current population projections.
I'd be glad to, Diane, and Hanya's an expert on this as well. In the world today, there are about 6.8 billion people, as you said. The UN's latest population projections put us in the year 2050 at something over 9 billion people. So we can ask, how's that going to happen between now and then? And it happens primarily because the fertility rates, the birth rates in the less developed countries, the developing countries, are so much higher than they are in the developed countries. So whereas about 4 out of 5 people in the world now live in the poor countries, the poorer countries, the growth rate there of population would be about 99%, 98 or 99% of the new people to be added in the world between this year and 2050 will come in those countries. In addition, the proportion of people who will live in towns and urban areas will increase, and the differences between countries will increase, with some growing rapidly and some growing slowly.
William Butts, he's president and CEO of the Population Reference Bureau. Hanya Zlotnik, birth rates have been falling in the richest countries. At the same time, these increases have been going on elsewhere. Could that begin to level things off?
Well, I have to correct something that you said. Fertility rates have been decreasing all over the place. We have very, very few cases of increases. But the difference is that whereas the fertility of developed countries, of today's developed countries, started decreasing last 2 centuries ago in the 19th century, the fertility rates in the developing world have mostly decreased since the late 60s. And there are countries in the world mostly located in sub-Saharan Africa, but also in other regions of the world, and they are called by the United Nations the least developed countries, where fertility decline has been extremely slow. And what is interesting about the future is that most of the population growth that we're expecting is going to be concentrated in the developing world because the fertility is still either medium or high, and particularly in the poorest countries, the least developed countries. These are only 49 countries, but they're the ones that continue to grow very fast.
Now, how does the percentage growth rate today compared to that of years past, Hanya?
At the world level, the growth rate of the population peaked in the late 1960s, and it's been declining since. It peaked at around 2% per year, and now we're around 1.7% per year. So it's declined quite a bit, but not that enormously because of what we call demographers call the population momentum, because when fertility starts declining, you tend to have already a lot of potential parents. So although each couple of parents is having fewer children than the previous generation, the population tends to keep on increasing even though fertility comes down quite quickly.
Hanya Zlotnik, she's director of the Population Division at the United Nations. Please join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. And now turning to you, Paul Ehrlich, it's good to hear your voice again. I know that in the 1960s, you made some very dire predictions about human life on the planet and population growth. Many of the assumptions you made then are not holding fast now. What has happened?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, Anne and I never made any predictions about population growth. We have always depended on the UN statistics as basically spread around and modified slightly by the Population Reference Bureau. We've been connected with the Population Reference Bureau for more than 40 years. And their predictions have been quite accurate. What I just heard is exactly what I would think, except I would just expand a little bit by pointing out that the world does not react to percentages. It reacts to absolute increments. And, of course, since we have such a much larger population today, the actual number of people being added per year has not dropped that dramatically from it is lower, but not dropped that dramatically from the peak in the 1960s. And, of course, the fact that the things that Anne and I and our colleagues said 40 years ago have not come exactly true is, of course, what one would expect. But for instance, if you look at the blogs, they say the starvation that the Ehrlichs predicted has never occurred. Right now, if you look at the UN statistics, we have almost a billion people hungry in the world, and that's roughly half the number of people in the entire world when I was born. Since the population bomb was written, it turns out to have been a very, very optimistic book, basically, because we did not know about the problem of ozone depletion. We expected the climate disruption would not occur until late in this century because half of the greenhouse forcing basically wasn't known. We talked about having real problems with epidemic disease, but AIDS had not yet hit. And one of the things that we discuss in our new book, Dominant Animals, still isn't in the conversation, and that is the next 2 billion people we add are going to have a much more horrific effect on our life support systems than the last 2 billion, because as we say in The Dominant Animal, people are smart. And we didn't start farming the marginal land and move towards the river bottoms. We did it the opposite way. So each person we add today, on average, has to have food grown in more marginal land, minerals dug from poorer concentrations. We had copper lying on the surface of the earth 100% when we started using metals. Now we smelt copper at 0.5%, and that has huge environmental consequences. Same thing with our water supplies, with our petroleum, everything. So the 2 billion that we face, that is, we're going to add by 2050 as many people as lived when I was born, are going to have a terrible effect on our life support systems, which are already staggering.
Paul Ehrlich, he's a professor of population studies at Stanford University. He's also author of The Population Bomb, The Population Explosion. And in The Population Bomb in 1968, Professor Ehrlich, you wrote, "We need compulsory birth regulation through the addition of temporary sterilants to water supplies or staple food. Doses of the antidote would be carefully rationed by the government to produce the desired family size." Considering the kinds of concerns you have now about this additional 2 billion people to be added to the planet, do you still feel that those kinds of drastic measures need to be taken?
Well, of course, we were just discussing possible measures, and I think the kind of measure that would be ideal would be everybody having to do something positive in order to have a child. The critical thing isn't, of course, how many children you want. It's what kind of world you want your children to live in, what kind of world you want your grandchildren to live in. And obviously, there's a huge unmet need for family planning in the world, although things are going more in the right direction now that we've had a change of government in the United States. But we still need to give people much more control over their fertility. And one of the ways, of course, that we have seen that we can get fertility rates down is by improving the condition of women. Around the world, women still lack the same level of literacy as men, and it's much too low. They don't have the job opportunities. There's still a glass ceiling, even in countries like Sweden and Japan and the United States. Women don't get the kind of deal they ought to, and if they did, we know from experience now over the last 40 years, one of the benefits of this otherwise wonderful thing is that fertility rates drop.
Go ahead, Bill.
I would just amend that by saying that over the last 30 or 35 years, the world has made very substantial progress in some of the important factors that Paul mentioned. One of those is girls' schooling and girls' literacy, not only in the places in the world where we might expect it, but as well in sub-Saharan Africa.
William Butts, he's president and CEO of the Population Reference Bureau. We'll return with more about population growth and its impact, as well as your calls. Stay with us.
Good morning. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show on WAMU 88.5. Diane will interview NPR newscaster Carl Castle on a special broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show at the GW Listener Auditorium, Tuesday, February 2nd, from 7 to 8 p.m. Ticket information is available online at WAMU.org.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Nnamdi Show, how Maryland became the first state in the nation to approve slot machines at a shopping mall. It's creating public opposition and some strange bedfellows. Plus, trade wars with China, verbal wars with Venezuela, and withdrawal from the war in Iraq. The international story sure to make headlines in 2010. The Kojo Nnamdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from Whitetail Resort. Whitetail is now open and offering skiing, boarding, and tubing, plus resort amenities. Directions from the Beltway, snow conditions, and live webcams at skiwhitetail.com.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
And welcome back. We're talking about population growth. It's expected to reach some 9 billion by 2050, currently standing at about 6.8 billion. William Butts is here in the studio. He's president and CEO of the Population Reference Center. On the line with us from New York is Hanya Zlotnik. She's director of the Population Division of the United Nations. And from Stanford University, Paul Ehrlich, he's professor of population studies there and author of numerous books on the growth in population. Bill Butts, I want to ask you about the last 8 years with the government's decision that family planning in the way of allowing the transport of condoms to underdeveloped countries was not permitted, or only information was allowed, but not condoms. How has that affected the growth in population in underdeveloped or undeveloped countries?
If we had been sitting here in the year 2000 doing this show, we would be able to, Hanya and I would, and Paul would be able to say that fertility rates are falling in every country of the world, with the exception of one or two. And the one, for sure, was our country, the United States, where fertility rates had not been falling. But in every other country, sub-Saharan Africa, South Asia, Latin America, generally, Europe, fertility rates had been falling for the last 20 or 30 years. Sitting here now, however, there are at least a dozen countries in the less developed world, probably more like 20, where fertility rates have ticked upward in the last 4 to 6 years. They've either stopped falling or they've turned around a bit, and we call this the stalling of fertility. At the same time, if I may throw in Europe, which is at the opposite extreme, with very low fertility, during these same years, most Western and European and Eastern European countries have also seen an uptick in their fertility rates. So there's something going on here. In the less developed countries, it may well have something to do with the fact that there is less investment worldwide in contraceptive knowledge, contraceptive availability, and in many places, contraceptive use. However, I would say that the U.S. contribution has not been zero. In fact, it's been fairly substantial the last 8 years. It just hasn't been nearly as substantial as it was, and it hasn't been growing to meet the need, the express need on the part of women for contraceptives.
Hanya Zlotnik, Paul Ehrlich talked about the education of women and how important that is to the issue of population growth. How do you see it?
I wanted to intervene before because dire predictions that Mr. Ehrlich made early in the 60s did not come true. But it's interesting, the population division has done some scenarios about what would have happened if there had been no fertility decline in the developing regions of the world since 1970. And Asia alone would have today 2 billion more people if there had been no fertility decline. But in sub-Saharan Africa, the difference between no fertility decline and what has actually happened is very low. So we have concluded that the population explosion, as we talked about in the 70s, has actually played itself in Africa. Now, it's true that the situation in most developing countries, including the least developed, is not as bad as it was expected 30 years ago, not in terms of population, but in terms of development. Lots of improvements have happened, including better education for boys and girls. But one thing where we're really being behind is in providing the family planning services that these populations require, because they don't have access to the means of controlling their fertility. And there are many examples of countries that were very poor and where the education was even worse than it is in some African countries today, and where a concerted effort by government and the private non-governmental sector to provide the means to women to control their fertility has made an enormous difference. And that's what has been lost during this last decade, in which country after country, especially in the poor ones, we see that the investment in family planning programs per woman has been declining.
Paul Ehrlich, what about China and its contribution, both positive and negative, to this whole discussion about population? You have the one child per family rule there. To what extent might other countries eventually feel they must adopt something like that?
Well, look, Diane, as we point out in Dominant Animal, we are living, you and I, in the most overpopulated nation in the world. Because, of course, it isn't just the number of people you have. It is how much each one of them on average consumes, how much damage they do to our life support systems. We have 305 million people in the United States, which is more than 150 million more than anybody's ever come up with a reason for having alive in the U.S. at one time. China could be a model for us. They at least have recognized their population problem. They put in place, as we predicted the population bomb, when governments discover there's a population problem, they usually go to extremes. There would have been better ways of dealing with their population problem, but at least they dealt with it, and they're the only country that has officially shown what they have managed to do in the reduction of flow of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere because of their one-child family, which, by the way, has all kinds of complexities in it.
I want to take a caller now from Shanghai and open the phone for Chris. Good morning to you.
Hi, Diane. I'm from Maryland, but I've lived in China for most of this decade. And to kind of trail on to what Mr. Ehrlich was just saying, you know, the United States, with the population that it has and the consumption, a lot of that is supported by China, where the people here are the ones that are producing all the things that Americans buy with a lot of environmental damage. But the question about the one-child policy, it is successful in terms of putting a control on the population here where I live in China, but yet there's no coordination when you look around the region. So, you know, you look at the countries like the Philippines or Vietnam, which have exploding populations, and big families are considered good, and it's not simply because they don't have access to contraceptives. If there's something to learn from China's one child policy, is there any way that actually other countries can take something from it and coordinate? Because in America, it's usually stigmatized more than praised what China does.
All right, Hanya Zlotnik.
Yes. Although there is a lot of attention on China because of the very open and, in a way, drastic policy they had. Everyone talks about the one-child policy, yet the total fertility of China today, in our best estimate, is something like 1.8 children per couple. So it's not that low. There's much lower fertility in Southern Europe and in Eastern Europe, where countries have not had policies that are as explicitly...
How do you account for that?
And Let me give you a better example.
Okay.
The Islamic Republic of Iran is now having a fertility under replacement level. It's not as low as China. It's around 1.9 children per woman. But they also had a very strong policy promoting small families. The same has happened now for Brazil, where even the government hasn't had that policy. It's the distribution of contraceptives has been done mostly by the private sector. So what we see is that the populations of the world have, I don't know if an inborn tendency, but they have the interest of having their children live better than themselves. And they know that if they have 7 or 8 children or even 3 or 4, they're not going to be able to give them the type of livelihoods that they want. So when given the means of controlling their fertility, we see case after case in which fertility goes down with some small support, mostly for women, because most of the contraceptives that are most effective are for women, but it also has to imply the agreement of men. That's where empowering women is important, and not only through education.
Yes.
But there are many examples of countries that have many different cultural backgrounds where the fertility has come down against lots of odds by some support in giving access to family planning and information on how to use these methods.
All right, Bill.
Let me add just another
quote. All right.
The only countries in the world where the fertility today is 1 child are Hong Kong and Macau. And these countries have not been having a policy to have that fertility.
Interesting.
So there is also something in the Chinese culture, because we see Chinese minorities all over the world tending to have much lower fertility than the other people with whom
Bill
they live.
But
there are actually about 25 countries that are poor countries that have below replacement fertility. I would add South Korea to Hanya's list with a total fertility rate of about 1.1. Whether that's developing or not, one might question. But Cuba, Costa Rica, Iran, which has been mentioned, Sri Lanka, Thailand, Chile, Uruguay, Brazil, all have fertility below the replacement level.
But what does that mean for that country, Bill?
Well, it means that their one thing it means is that their populations are going to continue growing because of this effect that Hanya mentioned, that as there are more young women from past fertility, even though their fertility rates, number of children per woman may be low and may be lower and is in many places than in the past, still the number of births can continue to be high and can in fact continue to increase.
I'm not sure I understand the difference you're making there. Explain that again.
Okay. The number of women who are eligible to have children
Yes. Is
one thing that affects how many births there are, and the number of births per woman is the second thing. Now, the number of births per woman is, by and large, what we've been talking about, the fertility rate or the birth rate, and that's what is below the replacement level. So below 2.1, approximately, births per woman means that over time, if that's maintained and there's no migration, the population will eventually begin to decline. But the key here is eventually. It won't begin declining now because of the other factor. Because fertility rates were high 20 years ago, there are now many 20-year-old women and 25 and 30 and 35-year-old women who are thinking about having children. So if there are many of them, even if the children per woman is low and is going down, the population will continue to increase.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And let's go now to Boca Raton, Florida. Good morning, Sharon.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I had two comments, and I was basically struck when Dr. Ehrlich was speaking by the same two thoughts that I was struck by when I first read Population Bomb from 20 years ago. The first was that as a social policy matter, if one is saying that we, for instance, have to require somebody to do something good in order to have a child, you're automatically creating a master class that makes a decision for everybody else and decides what is good and what is not. And that is ethically very problematic. The second thing has to do with my research field. I look at endocrine disruption, which is disruption of hormones, in the reproductive endocrine field for wild animals, and particularly dolphins. And the idea of promoting extensive use of, for instance, hormonal contraceptives creates a whole nother major environmental problem. We're seeing huge increases in the last 20 and 30 years in the water and in the tissues of animals from contraceptives coming out of women through the urine stream or just being flushed into the water system. And it seems to be disrupting in large swaths of environmental systems, and that's a major problem.
All right, Sharon, very interesting points, Dr. Ehrlich.
She's perfectly correct on the hormone disruptors. A lot of people think that the environmental problem that's going to put us under is going to be climate change, because it's going to have horrendous effects on agriculture. But it may be even more dangerous, the toxification of the planet, particularly with hormone disrupting chemicals, because we do have some nutcase possible solutions for climate change if it gets away from us, but we don't have those solutions for toxification. And, for example, it's not just other animals. In many subarctic villages, there now are twice as many female babies being born as male babies, and the normal sex ratio is about 105 males to 100 females. So really serious problems. On the ethical side, the really unethical thing is having more than two children in today's world. In other words, if the United States government wanted to do something about our vast overpopulation of the United States, they would say, patriotic Americans, stop it too, because the ethical thing is to consider what is happening to future generations. That does not mean, certainly, one class should not have more than others. There's no sign whatsoever of different human quality by race, class, or anything else. Everybody should stop at two, maximum.
Bill Butts.
Well, there are many people who would disagree with that, who would think that a very important thing is the freedom of women and of couples to have as many children as they want. And actually, if everybody agreed on that and acted on that, we could make enormous progress. Because contraceptive prevalence rates, that is the proportion of women who are eligible to have a child who are using modern contraceptives, has been growing over the last 35 years, but it also has stalled in some of these same countries I was talking about before. So if we gave all women, all couples, the ability to have the number of children they wanted, those projections that the UN made will be satisfied. Now, that still may be too many people by the year 2050 because their projections depend on, among other things, the total fertility rates of all countries compressing toward replacement level. To go beyond that and to say that every couple should have no more than two is an absolutely defensible position ethically and in terms of some studies that show the effects of population growth on environment. But I don't think we need to agree on that to agree to increase the delivery of contraceptive information and materials so that all women everywhere can have the number of children they want.
Do you believe...
Basically, basically, I agree with Bill. The reason for saying all Americans should stop at two patriotic Americans is that what we actually want is Americans having about 1.8, a TFR, a total fertility rate of about 1.8. But that doesn't make a very good goal. And actually, what you'd really like is people who are really great parents having four and a lot of people who don't care about kids having none.
Paul Ehrlich. He is professor of population studies at Stanford University and author of a brand new book. It's called The Dominant Animal.
A library has been written about the founding fathers. What about a rock and roll patriarch?
Abraham Lincoln and Washington and Thomas Jefferson are fine by me, but when the world can be changed by a gay black cripple from a town that nobody ever heard of, that's when I want to get out to, you know, pen and paper and start writing.
David Kirby on Little Richard, next time on Bob Edwards Weekend from PRI, Public Radio International.
That's Today at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
This week on Interfaith Voices, it's an introduction to holy relics, the bones, fingers, tongues, and other body parts of long-dead religious leaders.
It's really just a hair. There's not much more to it than that. And yet the meaning that the people around it bring to it, that's what gives it its real significance and its power.
I'm Maureen Fiedler. Join me Sunday afternoon at 3 as we discover the sacred in human remains.
Today at 3 on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU 88.5 is proud to be a media sponsor for the Blind Boys of Alabama with the Preservation Hall Jazz Band this Friday night at 8. The Washington Performing Arts Society presents the concert at the Warner Theater. The four-time Grammy winners will present their blend of traditional and contemporary gospel music in Down by the Riverside, a tribute to the spirit and sound of New Orleans. More information is at WAMU.org.
Diane Rehm will interview NPR newscaster Carl Castle on a special broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show at the GW Lisner Auditorium Tuesday, February 2nd from 7 to 8 p.m. Ticket information is available online at WAMU.org. We have a wind advisory in effect until 6 this evening. Sunny and blustery today, a high in the upper 20s, wind gusts up to 50 miles an hour. Mostly cloudy tonight, a low around 18, with wind gusts to 45 miles an hour and becoming mostly cloudy tomorrow afternoon, a high in the low 30s. 18 right now in Northwest Washington. It's 10:40.
This broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is recorded, so we're not taking any new phone calls.
Welcome back. As we talk about population growth in the world, Paul Ehrlich, I must say your last comment certainly drew some rather heated reaction. Here's an email delivered from a BlackBerry. The writer says, I want a world where my children would have the freedom to choose how many, if any, children they would have. Your guests are simply advocating eugenics, plain and simple. Who decides whether you would be able to have children? The government? You? NPR? What standards? Why would following communist China's example or Nazi Germany's apply here? Yes, let's follow China, Iran, and Nazi Germany and forget life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Paul Ehrlich.
Unfortunately, the writer doesn't seem to understand that eugenics is saying some people are good, some people are bad. The good people ought to have more children. The bad people ought to
Who
have less
decides,
children.
Who decides, Dr.
Well,
Ehrlich?
Well, that's the point. You let individuals decide, but you create a circumstance where they understand, and this is certainly the duty of government, that you have to have a number of people that can be supported. And people, as Bill points out, if you give them access to contraception, if you give them the right information, if you show them what's going to happen to their children and their grandchildren if they have too many children, if you take the focus off of how many I want and onto what kind of world do I want my kids and grandkids to have, then people tend to have the smaller families that are actually required.
Hanya Zlotnik.
Yes, I have to say that the world has advanced a lot since the 1960s. And one very important thing is that what Bill Butz was saying, that the right of every couple and individual to decide freely and without coercion how many children they want to have is something that is now part of the accepted wisdom of the United Nations. And by that, I mean every country in the world accepts this idea. Now, the question is whether governments, in especially the poorest countries, are taking the responsibility of giving the people the means to get there. But no one is saying anything like what Mr. Ehrlich wrote about they have to enforce a certain number of children for everyone. People could decide. And it's without too much preaching, people all over the world have shown that they can decide very rationally to have lots fewer children than through history. Because once the mortality goes down, and that's happening all over the place, mm-hmm. except for countries that are very affected for HIV/AIDS, and even that is now mostly under control, or it's going to be under control, one doesn't need to have 8 children to see 6 die and have 2 survive, which is what happened in history over a long period of time.
Yes.
So the main message is give the means, especially to the poorest people. The people in the middle-income countries, and China is one example, already have the means. And it was fascinating when you put all the data together is the Europeans reduced their fertility by using condoms and withdrawal. They didn't have modern methods of contraception.
All right.
And even today, they still use condoms a lot. There are some countries that rely totally on sterilization or very highly on sterilization, and no one is forcing them. That's what they decide to do. There's a lot of variety of means that people can use, and as long as you give them the possibility of choosing, they tend to choose rationally and responsibly.
Bill Butz, today is Earth Day. Let's talk about the connection between population and the environment.
Well, 8 years ago, the United Nations, the countries of the world, through the United Nations, identified 8 Millennium Development Goals, things that we really agree as a world should be accomplished, things like eradicating extreme poverty, achieving universal primary education, and one of those is to ensure environmental sustainability. 6 of those goals, including Goal 7, ensure environmental sustainability, depend critically on the level, on how many people there are, how fast the population is growing, how they live, that is, how they form themselves into households and how they consume, and where they live. Do they live near the coast? Are they causing coastal crowding, barrier reef destruction? What about forest destruction? What about overuse of the soil? Too many people in too little space results in environmental degradation. People consuming in ways that are wasteful contributes to environmental degradation.
What is the worst scenario you can see out there beyond 2050 if the population continues to grow at its current rate?
Well, you know, one could probably pick a dozen. because the population really needs to grow at a lower rate for 6 out of the 8 of these reasons in the Millennium Development Goals. So I could say poverty will increase. I could say the gains in primary education will decrease. I could go through all of that, but let me just mention one that we haven't talked about much. When we talk about migration, we've been talking about south to north migration from the less developed countries to the developed countries. We use words like brain drain and the like. I think that in the next 30 years, there's going to be a great deal more south to south migration between developing countries, between poor countries. As one country in a region lowers its population growth rate, as its economy expands more rapidly, another country in the region, the people will start trying to migrate there. We see that already in Guatemala to Mexico, where Mexico on its southern border has problems that I don't want to say dwarf, but are very much like the problems that the U.S. conceives that it has. We don't hear very much about that now. Similarly, in Southeast Asia, people moving to Malaysia, people moving to Indonesia from other countries, when this starts increasing more and more, the same kinds of ethnic conflicts, religious conflicts, economic conflicts, I think may well start growing in the third world, just as we've seen them in movements from the third world to the first world.
All right. To Jack in Whitsitt, North Carolina, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I'm humbled to be on the show here.
Glad to have you, sir.
Thank you. I am a humble farmer, by the way, and retired from juvenile court. Became impassioned about overpopulation and seeing some of the families that I dealt with on a day-to-day basis. I live in a county in North Carolina that's one of the four in the nation of over, or North Carolina is overbuilt. And the quality of life is really going down here for farmer to protect his land, he has to put it under some kind of easement or trust and hope that the state won't come in and take it over and pave over it. But I'm most concerned, I guess, about drawing some parallels between overpopulation and capitalism. Does capitalism count on people continuing to grow and then becoming more and more people to consume? Is that a problem that we're facing?
Bill Butts.
No, both the theory, economic theory, and the evidence over time within countries and the cross-sectional evidence across countries, is that population growth is not necessary in capitalism. And we can go back to Malthus, John Stuart Mill, Marx, and others to look at the history of this. But the empirical evidence is that there isn't evidence that relationship holds. Certainly population growth is one factor that can contribute to increases in aggregate demand that in a Keynesian sense keep the economies growing. But those economies can grow and can prosper, and can prosper without growing, as a matter of fact, without population growth.
All right. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to add, yes, all right.
Sure. Go ahead, Dr. Ehrlich.
Well, first of all, what we really want to have growth in is per capita well-being, not aggregate consumption on the planet, because that's what's basically destroying us. You got to remember, we already know that we're vastly overpopulated at 6.8 billion people. That is, we are losing our non-renewable, we're turning our renewable resources into non-renewable ones. We're losing our soils. We're losing our underground water around the world. We're losing the biodiversity that runs our life support systems. This is something the scientific community has been talking about for decades. Remember the world scientists warning to humanity. It said human beings in the natural world are on a collision course. Human activities inflict harsh and often irreversible damage on the environment and on critical resources. If not checked, many of our current practices put at serious risk the future that we wish for human society and the planet and animal kingdoms, and may so alter the living world that it will be unable to sustain life in the manner that we know. Fundamental changes are urgent if we are to avoid the collision our present course will bring about, and the magnitude of the threat is linked to human population size and resource use per person. That's not me. That's the entire scientific community.
Hanya Zlotnik.
Well, listening to that, what I wanted to say is that the population of the world cannot continue to grow at the level it's growing, because we have made some projections, and there are, of course, inventions, But if we were to continue to maintain everything constant as it is today, by 2300, and you have to give it time, the poorest countries of the world, the least developed countries, would have 120 trillion people to support. That, of course, is unsustainable. So we know that there has to be a limit to the growth of the population. And the issue is that the population of the world has been extremely successful at limiting its growth, and now we're facing with especially the problems of the poorer countries. Because the evidence shows very clearly that the countries that have been growing the fastest in terms of population have been doing the worst in terms of development. Any kind of indicator of development that you use is always the worst in the countries that have had a very high population growth. And it's easy to understand because since the resources, both economic and natural, are limited, the more you have to divide them among more people, especially young people that are not producing, you're having a large weight on the economy that doesn't allow you to get out of a hole. Negative cycle.
So, Hanya, looking ahead, as you have, to this unbelievable trillion-dollar figure, trillion-person figure, what do you see as a solution even beyond the educational question?
Well, I think that that's why the Millennium Development Goals are so important, because they talk about education, they talk about empowering women, they talk about reducing child mortality, and they talk about giving better access to family planning to everyone. That combination of things has some virtuous cycles that allow the populations to adjust, because with a little better education, with access to contraception, the next generation is smaller, and we have evidence in many countries, especially Bangladesh comes to mind, that when the government started giving access to family planning to women and couples, you interviewed women and you asked them why did they, and these were illiterate women, why do you want to have fewer children? And they said, it's because I don't want my daughter to live in the same conditions I want.
All right. Let me stop you right there, because so many women have reported that the men they are with refuse to allow those women to use contraceptives. We see this not only in developing countries, we see it right here in this country. Bill Butz, what do you see going forward? How do you overcome those cultural differences, even as you educate women?
Those cultural differences are important, but I want to pick out of what Hanya said. We know how to decrease fertility rates. We know scientifically. There is no mystery about it. This has been studied and studied and studied by epidemiologists, demographers, economists, sociologists, public health people. There are four factors that are involved. We needn't have all four of them. One is to reduce child mortality. When child mortality, infant mortality, and child mortality is going down, people do not need the same number of births to have a given number of surviving children. The second is female schooling. It may be broader than that. It may be female power, female roles, but that's not so clearly established in the science. It's probably true, but female schooling is definitely, definitely associated in a causal way with the increased use of contraceptives and decreased fertility. The third is generally shared increases in standard of living. If that occurs in a country, that tends, for whatever reasons, cultural reasons, economic reasons, to reduce desired family size, and therefore, if contraceptives are available, to reduce fertility. And the fourth is family planning, modern contraceptives. When any two of those are present, we see fertility rates falling.
At 5 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And one last call from St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, Mike. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. One thing I haven't heard about, and you've had Ray Kurzweil on your program twice in the past few years, does any of your guests factor in the notion of advanced technology, the way it affects humanity, and the way Kurzweil predicts by 2050 that we will be totally virtual, and that the environment will essentially take care of itself and population explosion predicted will not happen? Clearly, there's a momentum of population into the future, but do they address this idea of how technology will affect population in the future.
All right, since we're almost out of time, Paul Ehrlich, can you be very brief?
Yes, I actually have an avatar. One of the big issues is going to be what use will be put to the virtual worlds. Will we use it to decline population, to do the much... Bill is perfectly correct. We know how to control population. The big issue is how are we going to control consumption when we get the population declining. But the intermix of the virtual world and the real world is going to play a big role that we don't yet understand.
All right,
and,
Bill Butts, do you want to comment?
It's been increases in technology, namely contraceptive technology, starting with the pill in the early 1960s, that along with all of the delivery mechanisms and the messages that Paul has talked about have played such an important part in fertility reduction. I don't think there's any reason to expect technology increases to be any less prevalent, any less important in the future. The fact, in my opinion, that we don't know exactly what they will be doesn't mean that there won't be any.
This final email from Carol, who says, population control is always the elephant in the room whenever we talk about any social, political, or economic problem. Thank you for addressing the issue. And I think she's absolutely right. Thank you all so much. William Butts, President and CEO of the Population Reference Bureau, Paul Ehrlich, Professor of Population Studies at Stanford University, and Hanya Zlotnik. She's Director of the Population Division at the United Nations. Thank you all, and thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, and Denise Couture. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe and podcasts.
Good morning. A Prairie Home Companion is coming up next on WAMU 88.5. Diane Rehm will interview NPR newscaster Carl Castle on a special broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show at the G.W. Lisner Auditorium, Tuesday, February 2nd, from 7 to 8 p.m. Ticket information is available online at WAMU.org.
This is WAMU 88.5's Community Minute. I'm News Director Jim Ascendio.
And I'm General Manager Karen Mathis.
Many students in D.C. don't graduate high school, but there are